In this episode of The Ownership Economy, we talk with David Litz, the founder of Streetwell. Streetwell is a real estate development firm that buys distressed real estate assets, employs community labor, and is building an interesting model of transferring wealth back to the community through neighborhood reinvestment shares. As home equity is the most significant source of wealth for most Americans, and also for most citizens in most countries around the world, David is tackling the heart of American inequality head on. We highly recommend listening to episode 15 with David Casey and episode 22 with Luke Weber to complement this episode. Episode 25 with Brett Scott also discusses complementary currencies, which are mentioned in this episode. We hope you enjoy the episode.
So, David, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah.
We like to kick this thing off usually by just asking you to tell us the story of David. So start wherever you want, as far back as you like.
Well, David was the son of Jesse. No, I think I'll start with that. I kind of have to start with that. I'm an alcoholic. I'm sober now, but I had my first drink at 14 and I drank alcoholically from that first drink. And I won't go through the whole war story. I will just land it 22 years later when, after having managed to cobble together some kind of life, despite my drinking, which included a family and a career in government relations in Washington, D.C. and Annapolis, I bottomed out and was sleeping in the woods and smelled bad and all that stuff. And my dad put me in rehab, and I was pretty excited about the idea, which just shows you how ready I was. And I caught the recovery bug, I guess you'd say, in rehab, where I understood I needed to focus on myself and focus on change. And the main thing I think I heard in there is that in order to stay sober, living a life of service, helping other people get and stay sober, and then expanding that kind of service mentality to the community at large is what I came out of there with. I also came out early sobriety, crazy and, splotchy and shaky still. And so not that hireable, but one industry that was willing to take me in was on the streets, they call it property prez, which means property preservation. I think higher up in the buildings of Wall Street, they call it loss mitigation, asset management. And in the real estate industry, we call it REO. But anyway, what I got hired doing was cutting the grass, trashing out, cleaning up, changing the doorknobs of foreclosures. And we would work for these back then in 2003 for these national middlemen, these national servicing companies. And what was cool about it was they didn't care. Nobody cared that I was fresh out of rehab and had a few scrapes with the law, that I was in the Maryland judiciary case search. Nobody looked for my name there. And the entry costs were low. I had a crappy old van and I was able to afford a cordless drill and a digital camera. And I was able to work at the library to send my pictures in from any job I did. And so, right from the start, I had a contracting business. And then the other cool thing about it was it is like a legit entryway to get into real estate and contracting. If you stick with it, there's a million ways you can go with it. And I did that. I started building out a contracting company and ultimately got my license and doing that. And I also got a real estate license. And as I built out the contracting company, I did what I learned in sobriety was, in rehab was the thing to do to stay sober, which is to hire other people that were coming back from jail or rehab. I eventually started to get my real estate chops. I invested in a couple of properties of my own in Baltimore, in a part of Baltimore called Park Heights, which we'll probably get into Park Heights a little bit later. And then I also convinced some investors to back me in the idea of running a sober house. So all this I did just to stay connected and stay sober to recover. Never heard the terms social enterprise or impact investment or any of that stuff. But by 2010, 11, 12, I'm learning that I have a social enterprise. I think I heard that term on NPR or something.
Yeah.
And it's pretty unique. We provide housing and support services for people coming back and a path towards employment. And then that employment can be like to some skilled labor, some cool jobs. And then eventually I do like get connected to the social enterprise scene. I go to the Red F Accelerator. I go to the Miller Center, Santa Clara University Accelerator, and I get really connected and I kind of start to perfect the model a little better. I shouldn't say perfect. It's still really hard.
Oh, well, I think you mentioned too, and we were chatting about this episode too, some of the stuff that's happening with the company. I mean, it's not nothing. You've raised $1.5 million from I believe a number of folks. Like, there's a lot of stuff happening, but let's back up and kind of dig into a little bit, right? You mentioned REOs, you mentioned real estate, working in this space. And also that, you know, in the behind the scenes, you and I have talked about kind of the incentive, all the, I'd say, really misaligned incentives between the major players in the space. So what are some of the stuff that you've seen up close, right? So, you know, we've got some of these people already have really rightfully poorly earned reputations, right? Like house flippers and all that kind of stuff. What is the sort of confluence of factors you've seen in real estate? And what are the sort of, you know, that then enables you to bring some of these folks in, hire them, give them traditional housing and recovery? We can, if we can separate those two concerns out and say, you know, you got back in yourself, you know, when you were coming out of rehab, what are the sort of problems that you've seen in this space that are like top priority for you now that you're in this impact real estate space?
Yeah. So one of my first exposures to how this, so it's like this dark little niche of the American housing finance system. So one of my first exposures to how it goes, like one of my first days training is the guy that's training me. We have to go do an eviction, right? So it's a business of eviction in a lot of cases. Whole nother topic about that. But anyway, the way they did it back in 2003 is we would drive up to a homeless shelter and then dudes would come flooding out of the building wanting work, right? And so the guy would pick 10 dudes to take to the eviction. And then the pay for the eviction was $10, not $10 an hour. $10.
Jesus. Jesus.
And I mean, that anecdote I'm telling you there is so loaded. But so just to skip forward, one of the things I learned working for these banks, realtors, middle management servicing companies is that they suppress wages, that they really are trying to invest bottom dollar in preserving these assets and getting them back out in the market. And then the result of that is you get what you pay for, right? Like, so these houses are, particularly in poor neighborhoods, are not cared for at all, and corners are cut constantly.
Plus, like, if you're going out and hiring homeless people for labor and intimidation, I believe it's like basically there's got to be a Coasean theory of this, Martin, where like the bank is contracting and the edge of the firm is overlapping with the contracts. And then the firm's like, set up a security firm. All right, well, I'm going to find the lowest possible thing to control for what the features of a security firm actually are. My God, it's really something else, man.
Oh, yeah. So like I would perfect the speech about, I still use it to this day, but before you go into a house, you know, ladies and gentlemen, this is an eviction. This is not a pleasant moment in history. These people are being put out of their house. It is a bad day for them. Be respectful. And this is not a trash out where you can kind of take stuff because it's just going to the dump anyway. We are putting these folks' life, their personal possessions, out to the curb. Do not put their stuff in your pocket. You know, it's just so, it's so anyway, that's like a snapshot of what I guess the point I would be like right from the beginning, before I really kind of studied housing finance and knew as much as I know today, you can feel like something is not right about this. Yeah. And then, so I guess, you know, like the longer but short story is if you are in the business of preserving, you know, maintaining foreclosures for corporate and governmental institutions, you spend a lot of time where all the foreclosures are. And that is in the poorest cities. That is in what I now know are redline neighborhoods. We call them board up blocks because they hire companies like mine to go board them up, board up house after house in this block. So you kind of get like a firsthand, I don't know, there's this association that you just kind of instinctively develop. It's something, the way that we're doing this finance stuff is.
And sorry, David, you can back up. I think a lot of folks potentially might not know what redlining is. So if you can tell us, like, you know, these things end up happening, there are structural reasons, you know, that some of the stuff ends up happening. So if you could start with redlining, that'd be great.
Yeah, sure. So coming out of the Great Depression, one of the, you know, the New Deal policies that was designed not only to get us out, but to, you know, kind of build and preserve a middle class and protect it from future economic disasters was FDR's. He started the FHA, the Federal Housing Administration, and it was called a slightly different thing at the time, but you get it. So It's a secondary market. It's the federal government money, putting out money to mortgage lenders to encourage them to loan to middle-class borrowers in a way that wasn't done previously. So you could get in with a low down payment with a 30-year amortization. So everything that like you take for granted today in mortgage, that's where it comes from, is the New Deal. And it worked, it rocked. It's catapulted us into this middle-class home ownership that we kind of think of as the American dream now, except that right into the law from the very beginning were exclusions for communities of color. And the reason it's called redlining is the FHA literally studied the geography of the United States and figured out where African or American or Asian communities were and drew red lines around the map and said to lenders or builders, if you build in this neighborhood, you cannot use this program. And also, if you build into the neighborhood that borders this neighborhood, you cannot use this program. So what that meant was the government-backed mortgage lending was available to my grandfather, but not to all these folks that I'm hiring here in Turk Heights, right? And so what that meant is the kind of privilege, and you know, we're not rich, but we have privilege. The middle class affluence, you might say, that we have. It literally comes from my grandfather was an FBI agent who had made enough money to qualify for an FHA mortgage, you know, owned houses over the years, died, and then passed that stuff on to my parents and helped pay for my college and that stuff. So I don't know how long but I guess to try to wrap it up quickly, this is one of the key ways that I think, you know, folks don't understand that we have deprived communities of color of possibility that we just take for granted. You know, we talk about, you know, pull yourself up on your bootstraps and live the American dream. Well, it ain't fair, right? That's right.
I think one thing to kind of comment on and just kind of give some summary statistics. So like back a couple of years ago in 2019, effectively you had home ownership rates in the United States where white families or white households own about 72% of white households own their own home. And you look at Black households, it's about 42%. And so this has like massive ramifications, as you mentioned, for inequality of wealth. And if you think about it, that compounds over time. A lot of people, when they face a particular disaster, whether it's a medical emergency or something else, they can take equity out of their home, right? And so this is a compounding problem that not just in terms of financial compounding, but when you don't have that social safety net, particularly in an economy where you don't have health insurance for everyone, what seems like distinct social challenges start to compound on each other over time.
And can I just add on to that? So, redlining, I think, is starting to get out in the world and people understand it and also think, oh, but in the 60s, in 1965, Lyndon Johnson fixed that by, you know, the Fair Housing Act and the Civil Rights Act. I'm not even going to get into what happened in that decade because then a whole lot of other bad stuff perpetuated by my industry, the real estate industry, happened. But what I will, to get to your point, Martin, about these statistics, that statistic is actually going backwards now. So for a while, Black homeownership was on the rise, gaining, you know. But then after the crash, it receded. Why? Well, you guys are smarter about this world than I am, but I think when Fannie Mae decided to get in the game of mortgage-backed securities and leveraging and Big Short, all that stuff, what that directly led to was predatory lending and subprime lending that targeted Black communities in particular. So here in Maryland, we have Prince George's County, which is a predominantly African-American county that like really rocked because the middle class, there was a Black middle class growing there that was actually acquiring affluence and prestige. But that was also the community that got marketed to when all these crappy products came into play, all these predatory products came into play. So of course, when everything crashed, again, back to the point, where are the most foreclosures? Well, Baltimore City and Prince George's County. And like, that's just like a big glaring example. There's all these like little microaggressions along the way of where these predations happen, but we have to keep going, don't we?
Well, no, I think that was good context because now, like, you know, we're 14 years past that point. And as you said, places like these neighborhoods in Baltimore that you work in are now becoming targets or have been targets for nearly 15 years, right? For like easy peasy reclamation, foreclosure of properties, you know, development by flippers and all that. So within all of this, then I wanted to ask you, of course, you're a nice guy, but tell us a bit more about this, right? Like you're seeing this stuff up close. Yeah, you've had to participate in some shit that really just, you know, turns your stomach. But how did you realize that there was an opportunity to actually build, you know, something bigger in this space? When did you start to turn your attention to that?
Yeah, it goes like this. So eventually we have a social enterprise, and it's a partnership between two organizations that we founded. One is our for-profit construction company that does this work, and another is a nonprofit that we set up to run the sober houses and sort of programmatic stuff. And it is hard. I mean, so where we have been and where we're at today is we literally open our door and say, you know, whatever you've been through, come and grab a hammer, bring your trauma. In fact, don't come if you don't have any trauma. And it is, so we are absorbing a whole lot of what you might call programmatic costs in that model. And if you're leaning on for-profit, which our social enterprise model, we do, we're mostly self-sustaining through enterprises we run. It's really hard. So if you work for clients who are doing the thing that I described in the beginning, which is like not wanting to pay shit, it's even that much harder. So to get to the point, at some point we said, why the fuck are we working for these people? Why don't we go out and raise some money and just, you know, buy our own properties? And when we renovate them, we'll get to enjoy the equity we create by virtue of the renovation. And then we can rent them out to ourselves or to others, and we can enjoy the performance of those assets. And we know how to do this because we've been doing this for other clients for a long, long time. And then as you imagine that conversation and wanting to perfect that model, of course, you're going to try to pick up your assets where they're less scattersite, where they're clustered. So that brings us right back here, you know, to Park Circle in Baltimore, the community I'm in right now, in Sandtown, Winchester, which is another community we started in.
So if I remix that a little bit, it sounds like two things. One, you had labor market advantages because you have a bunch of folks that you gainfully employ, and you're not just going and paying the most desperate people bottom dollar to do this stuff. And then number two, as a result of those sort of like labor market advantages, you're working with these, you know, whatever reputation you want to assign to some of these firms, some of these shitheads, you know, my opinion being personal, you are then by doing this work, you're also like, wait, we actually see what this market is like. We see what some of these distressed assets look like. We can use them for other purposes, and we can put our labor value to work. We can use our actual expertise in the market to do this. And you're not even doing the same thing. Like you're basically, you're like saying, hey, actually, these guys are doing this in the bottom dollar way, and we actually see a market opportunity. Is that basically right?
That's true. That's true. Like we do not do bottom dollar budgets for two reasons. We're constantly trying to pull up wages, and we've been fairly successful at that. And we are getting better and better at doing quality renovations. So not like flip junk scam renovations that often go on in these neighborhoods, but quality down to the bones, gutted, and then all new systems, you know, get the lead out, get the asbestos out. Like, and then the other thing that we've known this for a long time, with the more distressed the asset, the more the larger the equity gain that you can earn from renovating it. So that all that points us to, you know, neighborhoods that have been abused for generations.
Great. So now we're kind of entering the modern.
Yeah, John, let me just touch on one point here that I think got kind of lost, and that's the labor point here, which I think is an interesting part of this model, just in terms of who's being hired. Because I mean, just some summary statistics on kind of the folks who go to prison, then come out and then are looking for a job. I mean, the US has crazy numbers around just what percentage of the labor force has been in prison, is on probation or on parole. I think it's, you know, over 3 million people at this point are in prison, on probation, on parole. And there was recent data that came out that showed that, I mean, this data is a decade old because they did time series analysis, but what they looked at, they essentially showed that for up to 4 years after prisoners were released in this cohort from 2010, 2011, up to 60, 65% of people couldn't find a job for 4 years, right? So just, you know, before we get into kind of the asset and ownership kind of potential of this model, I think the model of providing good work to people that have been out of prison is something that shouldn't be overlooked as well.
And for also sure. Kids that are trying to get off the corner, which is a little tougher because they're young and they think they have a viable business there on the corner, but we're doing that too.
Yeah, for sure. And Martin, that's a very solid point. Thanks for, you know, bringing that in. That's a ton of people. And like you said, when you look at it, like, you're not, in many ways, you're not going to be able to get a job because you fail that very first pass at, you're a former felon, right? Like, if you're, you know, obviously, if you're in prison, you were for a felony for the most part. So that is a very, very good point. So then, David, turning back to the structure of what you're building there, you have a nonprofit and you have a for-profit arm. Kind of tell us a little bit about the structure, right? And I'll just remind everyone too, like, we're talking about, you know, so the enterprise that David stood up here is basically results from his own work in real estate and as an REO previous to that, then seeing up front, hey, there's a lot of distressed assets in the neighborhood. These assets are owned by people who don't give a shit about the neighborhood or the people who are in it. And essentially, you're able to say, we can acquire these, we can regenerate them, we can put them on the market, we can use those proceeds to basically pay better wages, pay wages to people who can't usually be hired, and then also find a way to repatriate some of the equity gains to a broadly distributed audience of participants, right? So that's folks like the workers, tenants who might be actually in those buildings and all that. So backing up then and saying, this is really ambitious, right? So in 2018 or 2017, I think is around the time I think you mentioned when you started to get really aware of this opportunity. How did you tackle this? Where did you start?
So we went out looking for somebody to back us on the idea of, you know, loaning us money to buy a row home. And our first investor was, you know, an individual, you know, what you would call an accredited investor. Some guy's got some money in DC, but also very interested in impact. And he did that. He loaned us money, our little posse money to get our first home. I had these couple that I had bought in Park Circle back in 2006 and 2007 myself. I kind of donated those to the portfolio for all intents and purposes. To get to your point, so the idea is to distribute the equity of the portfolio to buy the most distressed assets we can, and by virtue of that, you know, create the potential for the most equity gain, use that, all that work that comes with rebuilding that distressed asset, to hire people coming back, jail or rehabs, or from people trying to get off of the streets, you know, and then to rent them out. And then the last piece is to distribute equity in this portfolio we're building to those workers, to the tenants who move in, and then to anybody else in the neighborhood that's like participating, showing up to the community cleanups, has been here for, you know, for 40 years and so on. I started, studying the cooperative movement, and I kind of put it together. Hey, what you're talking about here is could be some kind of worker co-op or some kind of multi-stakeholder cooperative.
Right.
So we converted the construction company to a worker-owned co-op. We started another LLC to put the properties under that the worker co-op owns. We got some help getting introduced to an organization called Seed Commons and its Baltimore affiliate called the Baltimore Roundtable for Economic Democracy. And that was our first impact investment relationship. And they are the ones that loaned us $1.5 million to go from that first three properties that we had to buy another five more. And now we're at the point where we've got a bunch of these rented out. Workers already have their equity by virtue of the cooperative structure. And we're having like this cool, meaningful discussion among the workers and with the tenants and with the community about, hey, we want to distribute this equity now to you all, but help us figure out what that would look like. And we want to do this in a way that creates impact for your community, but we don't want to tell you what good impact should be. So tell us, you know, if you were going to design a way to bring wealth and health into your community, you know, what would you go for? So
that's really great, because you basically preempted my next question. Well, a lot of people have zero experience with the idea of, you know, worker co-ownership cooperatives, right? You don't tell them, hey, you know, did you know True Value is a cooperative? And they're like, what does that mean, right? Because cooperatives have so many, you know, different definitions as well. Purchasing co-ops, multi-stakeholder co-ops, platform co-ops, right? So first, I think I'd say, what sort of cooperative definition does your current structure fit? You mentioned platform cooperative, I think, earlier. That might have just been me. I don't want to put words in your mouth. So what kind of structure do you have, first of all?
Right now, it's just plain old worker co-op, worker-owned co-op. I reached out to you all because behind all this, and I don't know if we'll get into it today, but you know, we have been tinkering around with building our own data finance and ops platform. Yeah, I think we can come back to this if we can. But right now what I'm trying to get to is when we get to talking about Streetwell, the new company that we've created, that is a company designed to look into the possibility of scaling this model that we are starting right here in Baltimore. And then part of that scaling would, I think, include a tech platform that empowered you to do the various goals, which again, we'll come back to.
Well,
but
coming back to it is a very good point, because I think before we get all Web3 podcasts too much of it, we always have, not that we are, but you know, we always have this problem of just jumping into the weeds of like this coin, that primitive, this, that, and the other. But I think that the social angle of this, which you were hinting at, was super important. You were talking about going to the communities and asking them, what do you want out of shared ownership? What do you think of wealth distribution? What has that conversation been like? Because, you know, really, that's where I was going, is most people have no idea this is even possible. So how did that start and how has it been going?
So it's hard. I mean, this is hard on so many levels. Like, I just think this is a really weird piece for me, but I am often explaining to the residents of this neighborhood the history of redlining, right? Which is like weird place to be. But in the case of the question you ask, going out to the community and say, hey, we want to distribute equity, what do you think about that? So we started with our first tenant, also happens to be a high school math teacher in Baltimore County, right? So we have a very sophisticated Excel spreadsheet that is our model for distributing equity to the various stakeholders, right? And it's got 100 rows, you know, because it imagines various forms of investment coming in and going out and so on. And so it took like a bunch of weeks and a bunch of meetings to get her to the place where she had her mind around what this spreadsheet was ultimately trying to do. And then I introduced her to the actual books of the portfolio we have, which shows the performance and, you know, where there's equity and where there's earnings. And so that's it. That's as far as we've gotten. And we've hired her, by the way, into the co-op to be what we call our community equity coordinator. So the idea is to train her on this. She's a member of the community. She's a tenant. She's a worker. She's African-American. She's a teacher. So the idea is to have her become our lead and our ambassador on exactly how to get out into the community. And then we have a kind of vague plan to go door knocking in September with a survey that starts to ask people about how they think about improving the neighborhood and impact. And then we have a couple feelers out with local universities, in particular Morgan State University, to bring in academia who might actually know how to do this stuff
nice.
To come in and help us. Yeah.
Well, I think it sounds like, you know, this could end up being something like a multi-stakeholder cooperative where you have, you know, the tenants all a piece, the workers all a piece, neighborhood stakeholders, like you said, who come in and who participate in a cleanup or something might get a piece. So is that kind of, when you think about the parties involved so far, is that an accurate depiction of who would actually be eligible to participate in the co-op?
Exactly. Distributing equity in this thing to those people. And then, you know, the scaling and the long-term thing we want to see is that it stays that distributed, that decentralized. Yeah.
Got it. And then when you look at, you know, companies, right? When Martin's going to be pretty intimately familiar with the history of this, but, you know, ESOPs, employee stock ownership plans, right? Things like this, that where you literally have to change the law in order to make them happen. Now, you know, 30, 40 years on, 50 years on, have these really standard procedures around them, right? There are legal instruments that say, oh, we'll set aside this much for the employees, we'll do this much for investors. And it's all very, you know, boilerplate stuff. But for you and I, we found with other co-ops we've talked to, it's almost as if you're doing it from scratch every time. All right. So in addition to that, like, how are you guys thinking of that, right? When you think of the fact that there's a for-profit entity that the folks will be participating in, and I think you said that you have a cooperative, right, that is either encapsulated by it. You don't have to get into your actual structure. It's fine. But one thing I'm really curious about, though, is for these multiple stakeholders, how are you folks thinking of vesting timelines and all that, right? Like you do something, right? You come out to the community and do something for a day versus you're one of the employees who is now like an expert at laying down flooring in a kitchen or something, right? Like how are you thinking of, I guess, pools of equity, allocating equity and vesting?
So a lot of ways, the easiest stakeholder to start that conversation with is the tenant. So we imagine the tenant comes into a neighborhood and is in a property. So like has that fixed participation in that neighborhood and that property for as long as they're living in the house. Whereas with the worker who comes and does the renovation and then moves on, it's a little harder to like figure out what their stake should be in and so on. So I don't know how deep you want to get on it. A couple things. One is one of the things I recognized for a while is that current law is totally limiting and that we have to figure out a way to change it to enable some new structures to do all this decentralized stuff that we want to do and that I think a whole bunch of other people are talking about doing. Co-op law is pretty limiting too.
I guess, Martin, correct me if I'm wrong here, almost every one of our guests who has either been involved in a co-op or started one comes in and says the exact same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, another cool thing that's going on is one of the organizations that has partnered with us and is interested is Kirkland and Ellis, and they're providing pro bono legal support to help us like really flesh out kind of these corporate and tax limitations and, you know, where we can push current law and where it would have to be changed. And it's so cool. Like every time we get on the phone, there's four of them on there and I'm like doing the math and how much that bill would be if they sent it. But anyway, so I don't know if you really want to get weeds on this, but I'd be happy to share that. Okay. All right. Well, so first of all, the structure we're imagining right now for this thing we're calling an impact real estate portfolio would be this 51%, 49% structure, and 51% ownership would be just plain old patronage cooperative ownership. And that those shares, one person, one vote shares would go out to tenants. And then the 49% would be kind of some kind of common stocky kind of thing that would reward or those shares would get distributed based on certain kind of activities. So for example, the tenant, when they come in, they sign a lease, they pay maybe $100 membership fee to become part of that co-op that owns 51% of the structure. And then every month that they pay rent, they get a little piece of common share over time. And then every month that, say, they pay rent on time, it gets enhanced. And then every quarter when we come by and we do an inspection and it's clear that they've maintained the gutters and kept the wood trim painted outside and cut the grass, you know, shares. And every time they show up for a community association meeting, a little bit of that common stock share. And if they don't know how to maintain their house or they're struggling with their finances, if they complete financial literacy, same thing. And this is getting really weedy. The idea there is also offered as like a critique on how we've done, I don't know, housing coaching or housing equalization in the past, which normally looks like you put somebody in a 6-week first-time homeowners class and you give them a $5,000 down payment grant and then you say good luck. And what we're trying to do is incentivize lifelong behaviors that I was taught, you know, because I grew up in privilege, you know, I taught you cut the grass and that you balance a checkbook and stuff like that. So, okay. And then you can just spread those kind of like behavioral incentives with, you know, incentivization stuff to just a whole bunch of other stuff that we would want to encourage and trying to, you know, incentivize a community to rise. That, yeah, that's, you might want me to keep going.
No, I mean, that of course, always, but I'd say like, there's some really interesting implications there because you're using equity almost, you know, this is money that you're going to pay anyway. So when I think about this model, there's so many advantages for the company and for tenants. Like it's almost the kind of thing that can really just change a rental market like that. Like that, I would imagine, you know, it depends on how you market it, you know, in terms of marketing, it's specifically like, you know, going out into the market saying like, this is what we're doing, right? But like, I just couldn't see if I'm have to pay rent, I would love to pay it somewhere where I know that the people that it's supporting people who are trying to get, you know, I hate saying all the typical things about prisoners that everyone else does. They're like rejoin society, upstanding member of society, when a lot of people who are in prison to begin with have been done so wrongly or for some stupid bureaucratic thing or whatever, right? So sorry, that's my little offshoot of prison thing when it comes up. But anyway, like I think that it's just a no-brainer, right? Like if the properties on this that are managed by this company, I'd just be watching them every day. Like, how do I get into this thing? This is amazing.
So when I'm an owner, am I an owner just of the property I'm in, or am I an owner in effectively the ETF of all of the properties?
Yeah. So yeah, if I started with describing the model, I would have described this better. So the idea, a bunch of critiques and ideas that we're offering here. The idea is also to change where to offer a competing way to think about home ownership in America. So we typically think you get your own home and, you know, it earns the equity over time and blah, blah, blah. We are specifically saying, no, you don't own that house. You own shares in the whole portfolio, which scales over time. And this kind of like, maybe you can see where I'm going with the crypto thing, but it scales over time so that ultimately the shares that you're getting are shares in a REIT, let's say, that owns, I don't know, pick a number, 10,000, 100,000 performing real estate assets. So that is a share that really has equity that you can sell later on in life that pays dividends. And so the tenant that we're imagining coming in, and this has been true so far, is either one of our workers or somebody from a community like this who is otherwise getting pushed out into bad living situations or can't sign a lease because they have some credit things, right? So they're invited in and they're invited, you know, incentivized to learn some stuff about home maintenance and financial literacy and so on. And over time, they are legit, you know, building like what looks like a 401k, you know, building shares in a real portfolio that has real wealth that one day can be cashed out. And we are incentivizing folks to stay and to continue participating in ways. And the thing that we are hoping is that folks will stay for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. And now their kids are getting to witness the thing that I witnessed, right? Which is mom and dad figuring out a way to live in safe, secure, healthy housing and using that housing opportunity to build wealth that they can then use to put their kids through college, let's say, or pass on to their kids or retire on or so on.
It's super cool. And have you talked to any underwriters about whether or not they would lend against, like whether or not they would step up a vehicle so that, because right now you can think of it, the payoff structure here is rather binary. So I'm coming into the home, I'm essentially getting accruing ownership based on either my participation or my rent. And it's already an interesting model, but the payoff structure to the individual in terms of liquidity is going to be essentially a stepwise function where you see a bunch of zeros every year and then you get this payout. So what would be really cool is if you could have this underwriter come in and loan against the portfolio, and then you could actually create a fairly comprehensive grants program with a grant or loan program, and that loan program could actually be managed in a partial way through the governance of the actual cooperative itself. And this is probably stuff you're already thinking about, but I'm wondering if you're talking to underwriters, you're talking to banks about this yet.
So that particular idea is brilliant. And this is why I came knocking on your guys' door, because you guys are super smart. So I'll tell you what we have been thinking about. So we have been thinking about the issue of, I mean, this all gets to like this conversation later about liquidity and reserves and runs on the bank, and you know, somebody wants to cash out, where do they cash out? Is there actually a public market where, you know, they can sell their shares, or are we keeping reserves, you know, to make sure that we can cover the the actuarial prediction of who might want to exit at any particular time. And then the only underwriting, and that's brilliant, but the only underwriting that we've really looked at so far is, you know, just going to impact lenders. We're really looking for loans. We're not like trying to raise VC or anything because we don't want to sell equity. So looking to impact lenders who will give us, you know, what you might call catalytic rates, because that really helps all this work and perform. And rates we would expect to be a little higher at the acquisition and renovation moment, which we could then refinance out to, I am hoping, and this is a stage where we're shopping right now, institutional impact investors, particularly large institutional impact investors, who have to like write $10 million or $20 million checks to, you know, social enterprises that can actually make good use of that money, pay it back, and can demonstrate like really cool impact. So when we get to a point when, you know, I don't know, pick a number, we're 100 properties or 500 properties, right? I don't know. Let's say Goldman Sachs has their own impact investment fund, right? With the managers are just pulling their hair out, trying to figure out where are going to put this money that will actually get it back. And I can show these millennial children of the gazillionaires that it's actually doing good things, right? I think this is like great for that to come in at the refi moment and offer us a long-term refinancing at a decent price. You can tell me if that's fantasy land, but
no, I think like RSF would be, I mean, have you talked to RSF yet? I mean, I think
RSF. Yeah, we're talking RSF right now about the first try at this, and they are listening. So
yeah, I would think they would be very, very interested in this. And then there's Elise Cherry at Blue Hub Capital in Boston would also, I think, the work that they do, they would certainly know kind of the funders that would be interested in it. But I think it's super smart because it combines kind of elements of the microfinance model, but in the sense that you have kind of this pooled community that has collective incentive to ensure that the value of this property goes up. You also have this ability to have discrete events where people can come in and contribute that aren't the owners themselves. And I actually think that the loan portfolio could actually be worth more over time as an asset class, as the property itself. And certainly it could be used against all sorts of interesting ways to propel the skills or, you know, I mean, there's also, I can just imagine all sorts of things from that. So it's a super cool model.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think like there were a number of things you said you wanted to come back to as we were doing this. And I think we're now hitting that point where it's good to come back to them. So I think one in particular, you know, you've talked about stuff like capture proof, hyper local governance. And now, you know, now that we have this in place and you're now looking at how do we distribute equity, how are you folks thinking about this? This is where it all is, right? It's like, how do you actually weight governance and participation in the co-op, not just financially, but now when you look at it from the perspective of governance, what are the sorts of things that people get to participate in? What is the local neighborhood? You know, what are the votes like? What make this a bit real for us? Because if it's a DAO, right, people are like, oh, I want to vote on this thing, whether you know, it's like something completely abstract that doesn't really have a real world effect. What are the kind of things that your tenants and stakeholders say, hey, this is the thing that we want to have a voice in?
Yeah, so we're just, again, here's why I'm knocking on your door, because I think I have come to understand about DAO world and tokenomics that there are theories and maybe even some code out there that could, I first heard the term, I think it was you, Jad, who I first heard the term, or maybe it was Martin, it was on your show about, you know, geofencing governance, right? And I don't know if there's actually code or a DAO that's out there that's figuring out how to do that. But what we're thinking about is Park Circle here, the neighborhood that I'm in is a neighborhood of 1,100 tax parcels, probably maybe a mile and a half square-ish. And even here in Park Circle, like the few blocks that I'm on right here down in the, let's just say, southwestern corner of it, don't really have much to do with what's going on in the northeastern corner. So now going back to the, you know, the dream, you can imagine Park Circle being somehow connected to other impact real estate portfolios in the city and then in other cities. The goal of the conversation is, how does Park Circle allocate itself some portion of the resources that it is creating and maybe even get some resources from the whole to enhance parking here or to take care of the dirty alleys here, have that conversation, vote on it and appropriate the funding. And, you know, the folks who are making that decision and driving that conversation have the governance power, you know, right here in this community. And people who are saying Camden, New Jersey, you know, can't vote on that. But at some point, like the whole fund decides, hey, you know, we have $50 million in cash reserves by now because this thing's been rocking so well. And we think we would like to create a, I don't know, a mortgage lending program, or we would like to put aside some of that to run crisis shelters in each neighborhood so that anybody who does run into housing trouble has a place to go, you know. But, and this has to be, this is a national pot of money, you know, so everybody should have one person, one vote on that, right?
Yeah.
So I'm here to ask you guys, how do we do that? Can you send me an engineer, please?
I don't know that you would, yeah. I mean, I think like, it seems that, so there's two ways that value is created here, right? So value is created through the cash flows and value is created through appreciation, right? And then I guess the third way is through a lending product, the interest on the loans. And so I think the if you think about kind of regional models, you need to tie the underlying cash flows of the region to the governance allocation for grant dollars or for investments. Right? Because if you have this one person, one member, one vote, and you have the geographic dispersion to allocate across different regions, I think that's where you're going to get into challenges. And there's certainly ways to, and we can take this offline, there's certainly ways with all sorts of, I mean, you don't even need crypto to do some of this. You can just do interesting kind of financial modeling. But I think like keeping the voting tied to the regional or the local cash flow generation and appreciation such that those that are the local members of the community that have the most impact on their actions actually contributing to that accretion and value is going to be a key component of this. But you've probably already thought of that. It's more probably just the devil in the detail.
And also like using that reputation building thing that is, you know, all the rage in W3 to also enhance, I don't know if it would be an actual governance vote power, but it might be agenda setting power. So somebody who actually shows up to the meetings in Park Circle and then volunteers on Alley Clean Day to cut the grass and the vacant lots, like that person should not be rewarded with just, you know, sort of financial things, but also like greater say. And then last thing too, we're also talking about, and I heard Kevin Owocki first use this term, which was capture proof, right? We're also trying to create a way that the equity that is distributed among these real lives, human beings can grow, but can't grow too much with anyone. So, you know, Warren Buffett can't sneak in here.
Yeah, I think on the first issue, well, I forgot what you said on the first issue now. And so I'm thinking about the second issue. So
participation, if you're really rolling up your sleeves, you should have some kind of more governance power. It might not be more vote. Maybe it is. Power, it might just be more agenda setting power, you know.
Yeah, so this is what I was going to say. So Stocksy, which is this digital cooperative, which you've probably heard of, uses this really interesting model that I think is becoming very common, where you have the kind of this two-stage process for proposals. And then that if a proposal reaches a quorum or a certain kind of threshold for voting, it goes to the general, it goes to the full kind of membership, and your situation might just be the local membership. So one could be based on participation, but I think there's also these other kind of second order dynamics that you could look at, which is, you know, people that propose a bunch of stuff and then no one actually, it never actually gets to committee. Like you could build a reputation based on, is this person's proposals actually germane to what people care about?
Yeah.
And once you have enough kind of data, reputation could be tied to the relevance with which people bring proposals to the group or bring grants to the group. And then with Kevin's stuff, you could tie that to quadratic voting. And that would be another way to your second point to make sure that no one individual has too much power. I don't know, Jod, if you have other ideas of kind of interesting new model.
No, I think that's spot on. And I think that like, you don't even need to, like Martin said, I don't know if he said it actually, I just saw him shake his head earlier, was you don't even need necessarily like Web3 tools here. You just need a, you know, set up agreements or, you know, intersubjective sort of relations that say, hey, we think that when a person lives here in this area and does these particular things, that gives them these rights within this. And then you just need a way to validate that that's true. That's it, right? That could end up being some of these Web3 tools, right? You mentioned geospatial NFTs and what have you. I honestly feel a little, some of that stuff is just really overkill for this, because you can very easily know if someone is a tenant or not in your area, or if someone is within the zip code. If you know, like that's basically all you would need to know.
Yeah, I guess I'm just thinking more like not of the tricky apps, but just the smart contract piece of it. You know, that it's, and I guess it doesn't, I mean, I don't know. This is where I get really dumb, but so DAO, what's cool about DAO is, you know, those three letters, the first two in particular, decentralized and autonomous. Mm-hmm. So that you're finding kind of some human-proof permanent way to keep things decentralized. Yeah, that's it, right? So geofencing, by that I mean, you know, if you're a tenant in this neighborhood, then the smart contract grants you certain powers. And, you know, I guess there's some platform that, you know, that makes that work.
If I was going to RSF or I was going to someone and saying like, look, we want to build this comp, we want to build those in two ways, right? So the first is that, like from a Web2 perspective, we need to have a identity management based on residency, right? And so you don't need, like you could just use license, right? For identity management for voting until you hit a certain scale. And then if you wanted to progressively decentralize because you wanted to get around the Howey test or because you wanted to move to a governance model where you get to a certain scale, that the coordination costs of governance are too high, but that's probably like 5,000 or 10,000 tenants, right? It's not going to happen at 500 tenants. Unless I think like where it could happen is on the discrete events, right? So like someone who comes and does this particular action, it's much easier to manage when you're dealing with the REN. But I would build the platform in two phases, right? Where you build the Web2 phase first and you get kind of that perfect, you get some funding for that. And then you layer in once you learn about kind of the Web3, because like ultimately the smart contracts are not going to be, I think, that hard to build. It's more going to be the tokenomics and governance and figuring that out with pen and paper. But the more I think about this idea, this is super exciting.
Yeah. And I forgot what you, the discrete, you used the word discrete. So yeah, I also imagine that Web3 or whatever we're calling it, crypto dApps could be powerful there too. So if we are incentivizing folks to complete financial literacy classes, we could use consensus verification, which I guess doesn't really have to be on the blockchain, but you know, there's a class and everybody's got an app and the apps recognize one another. So they consensus verify that so-and-so actually showed up for the class and stayed for the whole, you know.
Absolutely. Stuff like that, that definitely makes more sense, right? The stuff that I'm kind of being a bit more skeptical about is that, like, you know, you don't necessarily need any Web3 technology to look at the opportunity in your neighborhood and say, hey, I think we should use money this way. And then have a bunch of people who you know are in the zip code say, hey, that sounds like a good idea. Let's shape that into a proposal and bring it up the next meeting and then enact it and use the funds, right? Like that doesn't necessarily need any Web3 technology. But I think everything else you pointed out, yeah, there's some definitely some opportunities there where you're like, hey, proof of whether I did this class or not, entitling me, you know, entry to log in here and see what my vested shares are in the co-op. That makes sense, right? Stuff like that, that is definitely an efficiency gain from some of this tech, for sure.
And can we just rage to evolution revolution talk then? So,
yeah, please.
So, yeah. So the other thing I imagined when I first heard back in the day about dApps and ICOs was that these tools would be a great way to do that equity distribution that we're talking about and vesting. And then as I've learned more about, you know, is coin or ETH money or isn't it money? And are they, do they only have value because they're part of some liquidity pool and that somebody just made up valuations and blah, 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 stuff you know way more about than I do, but I know enough to be dangerous. This, if we are using some coin or token to do this equity distribution stuff and then ultimately trading, it seems to me that you now have like a real asset-backed coin, unlike, I guess carbon credits maybe kind of sort of is like that, but unlike, like it is otherwise absent, right? Like Bitcoin doesn't have any asset behind it. It's just got belief behind it. But in this case, the coin would actually be tied in the old fashioned gold standard way to real assets that actually create real wealth and really have a constructive, productive thing to do within the economy. And then also, and then just to get like really evolutionary, I'm kind of like trying to understand the grassroots economics thing, and I don't quite yet, but it seems like kind of in a similar direction. If that money now is used within this community to just do stuff, pay your rent, buy a soda at the corner store, whatever, you're also like giving folks an opt out to say like, fuck you, US government. We don't need your dollars. We don't need your Fannie Mae. I'll stop there.
Oh, no, look, no, you don't. I'm, you know, we've had a number of other folks come on who are building models like this, right? The resource finance people and the folks who are working on Collectivo, very much when you kind of put them the question, right? You say like, hey, are you actually trying to build like a local, you know, mutual credit based economy that is outside of the dollar? They're like, well, we're trying to figure out how to do it within the system, right? And like, that's, but there are very good reasons to experiment with that, right? Because Martin can elaborate much more than me on this, but you know, the various layers that the dollar goes through when we're talking about a central bank, monetary policy, international aid, inflation, all of that, like you just want to buy a Coke from the guy on the block, right? And like, and it's the same dollar here, there, and everywhere. And all people are really trying to experiment with is say, is that really the right incentive structure? Are there other forms of money and abstraction that should be allowed so that we have the right level of abstraction for this versus that? Right. So at the end of the day, that's really all it is. And, you know, the same thing that's used to really perpetuate and deploy massive amounts of energy, petrodollar and, you know, military might maybe isn't the same thing that should be used to securitize a loan for a house over there. Right. It might be right. So simple as that. And what is the design space of that, basically?
I think the key metric there would be the velocity of the currency within the geography, right? So how many times does the currency kind of turn over? And there's really good work that's been done on this on local currencies and looking at kind of, or complementary currencies, right? It's what they're really called. And how many times do they turn over within the local economy? And do they actually turn over more than, say, if it's just a dollar was introduced? Like, are you more loyal? Are you more willing to purchase things locally? Does that purchase kind of go to another purchase? And to achieve that, you would really need to have a density of providers within the economy that are willing to take that currency. And that's what I think Resource Network and David are trying to do, is they're trying to create that density. But then, like, if you created this token, you could swap with Resource Network, right? And so you do get some of this fungibility that you're talking about. And then back to what you were saying before, I do think this very much is a security token, right? You could probably design this as a utility token, but here you really do have the cash flows of a traditional financial asset that would, if you wanted to, allow you to create a security token that could be more easily kind of tradable. I think the challenge here is that you face a much higher test of, there's just kind of more legal risk or more cost in setting that up, I guess is a better way to put it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think now we've kind of hit the end point of all the things I wanted to get into with you, but I wanted to kind of give you an opportunity. We've covered Streetwell quite a bit, what it does, who participates in all that. Where are you folks at now? Kind of maybe close the loop for us and say, what's on the docket for you in the next 6 months? What are you trying to get done? What are the big goals?
Yeah. So the first, you know, the pilot impact real estate portfolio we did is a little LLC here in Baltimore called Rising LLC. And we have come to the end of our runway with that $1 million line of credit. So we are talking to RSF, and I just reached out to NCB today too. And there's a couple others I've pinged with to just continue the Rising LLC's acquisition and renovation of properties here in Northwest Baltimore, Sandtown, Winchester, and Park Circle. And then, so these are like the pre-Streetwell companies, the pilot. Streetwell is more or less a consultancy that I and my team members have put together to help us bring this to other towns and to, you know, create the tech systems and the legal thinking that needs to advance this and maybe get us to a point of scale. So I don't know what I'm allowed to say about how we're thinking about raises. So I'm just going to say we're heading for other towns, and there at some point, you know, there may be money. and we're particularly interested in Camden, New Jersey for a particular good set of reasons. And I think that's a good way to tell you where we're at.
Awesome.
I'll just add to this that we would, the models that we've built, the pro formas that we've built, our aspiration is we're at 8 properties now, that by the end of 2023, we would be around 40. And by the end of 2024, we would be around 90 and in 2 additional cities.
Amazing. And where can folks go to stay on top of the project and your work?
Well, I do my best to blather on Twitter and LinkedIn, and I'm easy to find. You know, I don't know that there's another David Litz in the world. So, and then Streetwell is on Twitter, also Street_Well. And I think that's about, you know, we're not a huge media operation at this point, but you can definitely find me there. And you can see me whining about Adam Neumann, who now says he's going to do rental equity.
Oh, God. Yeah. Don't get me started on this. I'll be here forever. We'll never end the episode. Martin's heard my hot takes on Adam Neumann.
Yours are great. Yours are so much better than mine. You're so much smarter. Hey, but yeah.
All I'm saying is, I think, you know, if you've proven that you can turn $22 billion into $4 billion, man, can I just show someone that I can turn 22 into 15? Like, can you?
Yeah, right.
$1 million? Sorry. What does it take? But anyway. Funny note to end it on. And I think, you know, when you look at the prop tech market, what you're doing at Streetwell is super inspiring, fascinating, and is an actual business too, which I think is awesome. So, like, best of luck to you, David. Thanks for joining us today. And yeah.
Yeah. Thanks to both of you. I'm so flattered, so honored. I've told you I'm a total geek. You guys are my favorite show. I listen to every episode several times over just to try to get happily as smart as you and your guests are. So I'm just super flattered. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks for joining us.